Welcome, listeners, to the NK News Podcast, recorded here in Seoul on July 9, 2018. I am your host, Jacko Zwetsluth, and joining me today in the studio is retired Lieutenant Colonel Steve Tharp. We will be talking about meeting with North Korean military officers across the table at Panmunjom, as well as cycles of US-North Korea negotiations. Once again, NK News is offering a free year subscription to one reviewer who reviews our podcast, not only at iTunes, but also at other platforms. And you can save $50 off your NK News subscription by using the code PODCAST at the checkout. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with others so that our listenership will continue to grow. Steve Tharp is a retired U.S. Army officer whose 28-year career included 14 years in career-based assignments in the 2nd Infantry Division and the UNC Military Armistice Commission, as well as stateside assignments in the 82nd Airborne Division, 1st Ranger Battalion, and the 24th Infantry Division. After retiring, he served another 12 years in Korea as a U.S. civil servant, managing the U.S. Forces' Korea outreach activities and the Good Neighbor Program. A Korean and Mandarin Chinese speaker, Steve earned his Master's in Asian Studies from the University of Hawaii and Postgraduate Studies in Korean Studies at Yonsei University, where he also taught classes in Korean Studies and the Korean War. A veteran of hundreds of meetings with North Korean Army and Chinese Army officers at the Joint Security Area near Panmunjom, he is currently writing and publishing a series of frontline tourism books designed to educate the public on the DMZ and the Korea Armistice Agreement. Full disclosure to listeners, I've known Steve for 14 years, and I'm as pleased as punch to have him on the show. So thanks for coming today, Steve.
Glad to be here, Jacko.
Okay, could you tell us when you first came to Korea and why and in what capacity?
First time I came to Korea was July 11th, 1979. It was a Wednesday. And I was a young soldier being assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division. I was an infantry corporal at the time, though I had been promoted en route without really knowing it. So I was a sergeant when I arrived, and I was assigned to an infantry battalion at Camp Hovey near Tongdichon in the 2nd Infantry Division. And fortunately, I was in the reconnaissance platoon, and so we got to do a lot of exciting things in gun jeeps and along the DMZ and stuff.
Okay, and it was 10 years after the end of the, what some people call the Second Korean War, during which lots of things happened in the late 1960s.
Exactly.
So it was a relatively quiet period.
Right, and there were some people who lost their life during that period, but nobody in our unit.
Now, unlike many of your cohorts, you speak both Korean and Chinese. Was it difficult to learn those two languages?
I think the Chinese was much easier. That was the first language I learned. And that's because the grammar is fairly simple compared to Korean. Korean grammar I've always found very difficult. And my wife will testify that I still screw it up a lot today. The Chinese is scary to people. And I think that's because of the tones as well as the Chinese characters. But really, to be fluent in your knowledge of Korean language, you need to know Chinese characters, same as with Japanese. In the U.S. government, we rate languages by category of difficulty, yep, with one being easiest and four being hardest. And the four level four languages are Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Arabic. I never studied Arabic. I did study Japanese. I've completely forgotten it now. But it was my belief that Korean was the most difficult, Japanese a very close second, and Chinese a distant third. Originally had designs to learn Korean, and one of my mentors, one of the captains that I worked around in 1980, said, you need to learn Chinese first before you learn other Asian languages. So when offered the opportunity to become a foreign area officer and go through this extensive 4.5-year training program I was in, I said I want to do Chinese first.
You mentioned that you were here in 1980. That was also the time of much action and activity here in Korea, the Gwangju Massacre, or the Gwangju Uprising, whatever you want to call it, the Gwangju Democratization Incident. You said that people over the years have repeated allegations to you that Americans were involved in that, but you have something to say about that?
Well, you know, and it's only a few people on the extreme that say that American soldiers were involved in the killing down there. My unit was on an alert status at the time that was a normal rotating alert status among the infantry battalions in the 2nd Division. And so if Americans would have been there, I would have been there because it would have been our unit that went down there. The Americans did allow the South Koreans to withdraw OPCON or withdraw forces that were under the OPCON of the CFC commander. But to be honest, it's not an allow thing. It's the government of Korea that decides which units are going to be under the OPCON of the Combined Forces Command and which ones aren't. So they can come and, you know, place them and retrieve them at will.
You were also here during the assassination of President Park Chung-hee. What was that like for you?
That was a little more scary. My battalion was training up near where the Gloucesters had fought in the Korean War and were surrounded. And in fact, I was on a hill right across the highway from there when the brigade commander came up and said, well, if there's a war here, just do your best. And he had been a lieutenant in the Korean War, and his unit had been the first ones to break through to the Gloucester positions. So he took me walking around the positions, showing me where the machine guns had been and the piles of dead Chinese and things like that, and then got in his Jeep and said, well, do your duty, Sergeant Tharp.
Oh, gosh.
On the other hand, we still didn't have any ammunition yet because this...
Oh, it wasn't a live fire exercise then.
This was the Jimmy Carter Army, and we didn't have enough money for repair parts to keep our trucks moving. So our trucks with all the ammunition were back in Camp Hovey, and it was really a few days before they got the ammunition up to us. And then the DEFCON, I think, had dropped from 4 to 3 at that during that period.
I need you to briefly explain some terms for our listeners. You recently wrote a newspaper column about the difference between Panmunjom and the Joint Security Area. A lot of people use those terms interchangeably. What is it that we need to remember about those two places?
Everyone uses those terms interchangeably, except for maybe me. The Panmunjom is the historical site. It's in North Korea. It's about 600 meters inside North Korea, inside the DMZ. And that's where the original armistice negotiations took place, starting in October of 1951 and continuing through the signing of the armistice in July of 1953, and then for a few more months until the Joint Security Area was built. People that go on tours to the Joint Security Area from the north side say that they're allowed to go through there, the Korean People's Peace Museum, and
right,
see the axes that were used in the 1976 axe murders, and see the table where the American imperialist dogs came and surrendered to the Korean People's Army. That's in the original armistice signing building that was
right,
put together in a couple days just to house the signing of the armistice.
And that there was what we would call Panmunjom.
That's the real Panmunjom.
And where the Joint Security Area is with the blue and silver buildings that people go to see, that's not Panmunjom.
Technically, no. However, everyone calls that Panmunjom. Technically, that was created as a new facility that would be along the military demarcation line. Panmunjom itself was north of the military demarcation line that separates north and south.
Hmm.
And the Joint Security Area was designed to be on both sides of the military demarcation line, with the buildings where the actual negotiations taking place being where the military demarcation line should be.
Now, in the biography that I read earlier, I explained that you have had hundreds of meetings with North Korean and Chinese army officers. Could you tell us a little bit more about them? What was the purpose of all those meetings?
Well, the purpose was always in some manner to be armistice related. Some of the meetings that we had discussed about the location of military demarcation postings.
Oh, the markers,
the
signs?
Markers, yes. Other ones. One time we had a couple of meetings over a North Korean soldier back in September of 94, sneaking across in the early morning hours to our side to pick up chestnuts that had fallen.
Hmm. Did he get some?
Yeah, he got some chestnuts. And so it was a great chestnut heist. It was the subject of a couple meetings.
Would that have been dangerous? Was there a landmine or something nearby?
No, there's not an issue with landmines. And nobody's going to shoot over some chestnuts.
Not if they know that that's what he's doing, I guess.
Yeah, and it was clear. He only came a few feet across and in a place that's easy to see. It's both on camera as well as very observable from the guard posts on our side. Other subjects included return of Korean War remains from the north, as well as the return of dead North Korean soldiers from our side.
Ones that washed down in the floods or
yeah,
something?
Typically, that's how you get them. Most of the rivers, all but one, that flow through the DMZ flow from north to south. So in August, when you get the heavy flooding, not the monsoons, but after the monsoons, when you get the torrential flooding, we would typically find some soldiers on our side. In the summer of 95, that was a... We had a big harvest that year as the famine had sent the soldiers to the riverside to fish. And so we had six fall in and wind up on our side that year. We would fly up, pick up the remains, bring them back to Yongsan, and then they would be placed in the mortuary there in the army base in Yongsan. And as soon as the North Koreans could confirm that this was their guy, and we would give them the uniforms and things so that they could search for the identifying marks, then they would accept the remains back, and we would have a couple more meetings based on that, on where to do the ceremony, when. It was pretty standard stuff.
It seems like quite a rigmarole, though, doesn't it?
I guess we needed a job.
Okay. So would it be accurate to say that the meetings there, the UNCMAC meetings, are it wasn't big picture, how do we sign a peace treaty? It was all very practical, day-to-day, small picture.
Typically, yes. Occasionally, the big picture things would be brought in. For instance, when the North Koreans withdrew from the Military Armistice Commission, they demanded that we tear our Military Armistice Commission component down and we establish an organization similar to the one that they established 3 weeks later, made up of just U.S. officers.
They didn't want to see South Koreans anymore.
Right. That was a time when the North Koreans were very angry with the South Koreans because the Kim Dae-jung administration had called Kim Il-sung the murderer of 4 million Koreans because of the start of the Korean War. This was right after he died in 94.
That would have been Kim Il-sung, not Kim Dae-jung.
I'm sorry, Kim Il-sung. And it wasn't until Kim Il-sung came out of office that they were actually able to get something started again in the North-South arena.
And how would you communicate your intention or desire to hold a meeting to the North Korean side?
In those days, we had a tactical landline that ran from our side to the other and had a little, in the Army, we call it a TA-312 telephone. So it's got a couple of D-cell batteries in it, and you crank it, and it goes through a little wire to the other side and makes a sound, and then the guy picks it up and says, yeah, what do you want?
Is it the kind that we used to see in MASH?
Yeah, it would be very similar to that.
Okay. All right, so really a very old-style telephone.
Yeah, it was very primitive, and we used that until 2002 when they replaced it with a more modern phone that, of course, we paid for and put in.
Which building on the south side was that telephone located?
That was in the Joint Duty Officer's Office, which, as you're looking north from the steps of Freedom House, it's the blue building on your right.
Wasn't there also a pigeonhole for letters?
Well, in the NNSC plenary building, which is
the Swiss and the Swedes.
Well, it's Swiss, Swedes, Poles, and Czechs.
Yeah.
That was the blue building to the furthest west or left as you're looking from the Freedom House. Both sides of that, there were boxes for the UNC and for the North Koreans and the Chinese for the NNSC to put their weekly meeting reports into.
Ah, okay. All right. So they would. So the NNSC would communicate in writing through the letterboxes, but the UNC would communicate through the phone line.
Right.
Okay, got it. Practical matters. So, if let's say the southern side, the UNC side, wanted to repair a building or repaint something or send a guy out to sweep up leaves in the autumn, is that the kind of thing that you'd have to have a meeting about?
Right, and that would be at a very low level. Usually that would be the joint duty officer who has historically been a Navy lieutenant commander. He would call for a meeting with his side, and they would come to terms with that. Now, since 2002, the joint duty officer has kind of been pushed out of some of these minor chores, and it's been elevated to the lieutenant colonel and colonel level because the lieutenant colonels and colonels aren't getting other meetings.
Right. What country is the JDO, the joint duty officer, from?
He's an American.
He's always American.
Yeah, and in the last few years, they've had assistance for him that have come from New Zealand and Australia, I believe. Mm-hmm. The current ones are from New Zealand.
Now, I've known you for 14 years, so I've heard some of your stories about these meetings with North Koreans, and I wanted to ask you to recount three of those stories today. The first one, if you would, could you share the grabbing of the crown jewels incident?
There was a officer on the other side, a senior colonel named Pakim Su. He's since become a general, and hopefully I can get him fired with this podcast.
If they're listening.
Pakim Su is a very crude man, and this was back in the boys will be boys era. One time we had to do a U.S.-only meeting, and so we used a Korean-American...
Without South Koreans.
Right, without South Koreans. To include our translators, I went and found a Korean-American officer that happened to be female, and she was the translator for us. And at one point, Pak came over and grabbed her, what we would call a sexual assault, on her chest. And
just during the meeting?
Well, it was after the meeting when we were kind of in a little informal session, so I had to step in. Say, Colonel Pak, we can't do that. About a year later, I'm crossing behind Colonel Pak in an informal meeting where we were drinking.
This is in one of those blue buildings.
In the blue building to the right, to the east as you're looking north from the Freedom House. And Colonel Pak reached around behind me and sexually assaulted me, grabbing the family jewels, as you say. And after a little exchange there, I got a couple laughs out of all the Korean officers with my response to Colonel Pak's actions.
Some ribald humor.
Yes. And 2 months later, as we were getting ready to leave a meeting, and it was one that had broken up into three pieces, and I was translating between Colonel Pak and my boss. As Colonel Pak is getting ready to leave, he decides he's going to make another play for me. This time I block his hand, and I return the assault.
Wow.
For him.
So you leaned in for a quick squeeze.
Yeah. A couple years later, we had a repeat performance of that when he was in the general officer's talks and I was a lieutenant colonel. He again grabbed me. I wasn't really ready for him. And so as soon as he lets up, I immediately reciprocate. And so I guess I'm the only officer on our side that's really had the North Koreans by the balls in negotiations.
Did your boss watch any of these incidents?
One of my bosses did see one, and he hadn't heard about the first one. He just saw the first reciprocation.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, he was a little flustered by the whole affair until we explained to him. And then he just said, okay, boys, just keep your hands to yourself in the future.
Okay, now... That was one of the stories. Could you tell us the story about getting drunk with a North Korean officer in the JSA on cognac as a strategic, well, as a strategy?
In that time, during the 90s, it wasn't uncommon for us to drink with the North Koreans during meetings. We'd have a formal session and an informal session. A lot of times it'd just be beer and sandwiches.
Would that be in the same building?
Yeah, in the same building. Sometimes the North Koreans would bring Pyongyang Pamsul or Pyongyang snake wine.
Wow, that's dangerous stuff.
Really horrible stuff. And something that you would get an aftertaste from the next day even. It was just that bad tasting. And we would bring Chivas or cognac or something. Well, we had a new officer coming in and he was going to meet his counterpart who was the big alcoholic on the other side. And he really liked cognac, and our officer was a Mormon, so he didn't drink.
Right.
And the general and the secretary said, okay, Steve, you need to go up and attend the meeting. We need to get a colonel's level meeting on Thursday. This was on Tuesday. And so whatever it takes, if you have to take over the meeting from the other officer, then go ahead and do that. Whatever you do, come back at the end of the day with a colonel level meeting scheduled for Thursday. We proceeded at 9:30 to start drinking a bottle of cognac.
9:30 in the morning.
Yeah, and I'm not I'm a beer and wine and soju drinker. I'm not a whiskey and cognac and bourbon drinker. I'm used to drinking things that aren't nearly so powerful.
Right.
And we drank the bottle of cognac in the morning. At lunchtime, I went over to the NNSC camp for lunch, met the generals, and had a beer just to kind of keep my hands steady. And They said, great job, Steve. Go get them in the afternoon. And I went back and we drank a bottle of Chivas in the afternoon.
Is it just the two of you? So it's you and the North Korean alcoholic general?
Well, yeah, we're the ones doing the drinking. There's right. others in the room.
Right.
And to include the translators. But it's really digressed down to just he and I swapping shots. By the end of the day, we had the meeting and everyone was happy, and I was still drunk the next morning when I got to work.
So you had obtained from him a commitment to get a colonel-level meeting on the Thursday.
Right. Now,
which is the whole purpose of you going there in the first place.
Right. And then on Wednesday, we canceled the meeting for some inane reason that I can't remember right now. And so we never had the meeting.
So the whole drinking session was for naught.
Well, I think there was a lot of damage in my liver after that. The other thing that came out of that was the North Koreans never drank heavy with us again after that. And so any alcohol at sessions after that was limited to maybe a beer or two.
Right. So you're basically single-handedly responsible, you and the North Korean general you were with, single-handedly responsible for ending any heavy drinking in the JSA.
I think when he went back, he got in trouble for being that hammered. He wasn't a general at the time, but he is now.
But he didn't give anything away that he shouldn't have, apart from perhaps agreeing to a meeting that wasn't planned. Is that right?
They don't agree to anything. They have to get permission.
Ah.
So he had runners going back and forth to Panmunjom, getting on the phone to Pyongyang, and the guys at Pyongyang finally agreed.
Now, there was also a third incident with a Christmas party with North Korean counterparts in which a joke was made about your missus?
No, no. It was before that. The North Koreans had met her at a previous party, and they had commented that they would all like to meet her again, and how she found them also romantically attractive. And I pointed out that on their salary, they probably couldn't afford to buy a pair of her shoes in a year. And so I don't think she was going to be that attracted to him at the end of the day.
That sounds like a very unusual party to be at. How did your wife, what did she make of it all?
She thought it was pretty interesting to be in the same room with the North Koreans and the Chinese. This is,
again, in one of the blue UNCMAC buildings?
No, this was in one of the middle silver building on the left. Typically, what had happened over the years was every year on the 27th of July, there would be a birthday party for the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission.
Ah, which is the day that the armistice was signed.
Right. The party would occur in that building. In fact, in 1989, during one of those get-togethers, a Chinese officer and his wife defected during the party to our side.
Oh, wow.
Kind of as a protest over the Tiananmen Square. The North Koreans quit doing those in 1991, but they agreed to attend in 1994 because they were really pushing hard to get us to go and come to an agreement for the agreed framework, you know, which was finally agreed to in October. And so this was one instance where we were at the strategic level as a mouthpiece, you might say, from the North Koreans back to the U.S. government.
I remember that you told me that some of your, at least one of your senior officers in the UNCMAC seemed to misunderstand the role and function and thought that he could negotiate something on a higher level. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't think it was that he misunderstood his role. He thought that he had more influence than anyone could really have on his North Korean counterpart. And he just thought if the two of them could get together, they could solve the peace of the Korean Peninsula. And so we had a lot of meetings. He had actually one.
This is someone who's become more famous in recent times, isn't it?
Yeah, he's become more famous in recent times. We'll just leave it at that. But he had some meetings and really thought he could make a breakthrough without really understanding who he's dealing with and not understanding that all decisions come from the highest level at Pyongyang, that even this lieutenant general at the JSA did not have the ability to decide stuff and was not as influential with the main leadership as probably we would have liked for him to be.
In the late 1990s or early 2000s, I forget exactly when, I believe you visited Northeast China for your commanding officer, and one of your side missions was to try and bring back some memorabilia.
Well, we didn't visit for him. It was an orientation trip for another officer, and because China's a two-man rule type of place, he couldn't go there by himself. So part of my mission was just to kind of get a feel for how the North Korean language sounded again, because the people in Northeast China, the ethnic Korean people there, their accent is much closer to the North Koreans than it is from the south to the north. So we were there, and because we were there, my boss at the time said, hey, gave me $400 or $500, I don't remember, and said, give me all the North Korean and Chinese army medals you can get.
Ah.
But if you can't get any of those, then give me all the Kim Il-sung badges you can get. So I think we ended up coming back with 130 Kim Il-sung badges that we had bought right there at the border at Tumen on the Sino-Korean border. This was right after the June 15th summit in 2000, literally days after there.
About a year after that, I ended up buying a couple of those badges from your boss on eBay. So I think he did quite nicely through it.
I'm sure that he was announcing them as last one left.
Right. I think it was. And this is a couple of years before I met you, so I didn't know the provenance of them at that stage. All right. Now, let's talk about more recent events. You've been in and out of Korea for decades. You've seen and experienced a lot. I really want to hear your thoughts on the recent summit meetings and the current process that we're in. Mike Pompeo, of course, was just in Pyongyang this last weekend for a follow-up meeting with Kim Jong-chol. What's your take? What's going on here?
I think we're in the classic North Korean negotiation cycle. When I was at the Armistice Commission 20 years ago, the guy that is selling the Kim Il-sung badges on eBay had actually kind of developed this eight-step cycle from his readings of the memoirs of C. Turner Joy, who was the original armistice negotiator, the Navy admiral that met with the North Koreans from 1951 to 52. It's really very simple, but very brilliant in that they can't get out of this do-loop cycle. And so the first two steps are cause the appearance of tension and blame us for the tenseness of the thing. Really try to ramp up tensions as high as they can, because the higher you ramp the tensions up, then the bigger the breakthrough you can have. And that's step three. Quickly agree in principle to a major improvement in relations. And so these summit meetings, this stuff was really in principle. Although the April 27th summit between President Moon and Kim Jong-un, they had some substantive things on there. Most of it was very general, and almost everything had been agreed to before in a South-North forum going back to 1972. I didn't see any of this as a big deal, and then the breakthrough with President Trump, or supposedly the breakthrough. And everybody said, well, you know, we've never done that before. We've never had a U.S. president. At the same time, nothing has really changed. And in fact, his document was probably the least specific that I've seen of any of these high-level things. The North Koreans have a great way of agreeing in principle. And all that means is you're ready to start the negotiations. Nothing has been agreed to. And so that's what Secretary of State bumped into this last weekend. He is finding out that nothing was agreed to. The next few steps: set artificial deadlines to pressure the other side, politicize and draw out the negotiations, and blame South Korea and the U.S. We're in that part of the cycle right now, steps four through six. And specifically, we saw the North Koreans blame the U.S. For using gangster tactics. Not sure what gangster tactics are, but we're apparently guilty of that. And so we don't know if they're using the deadlines or if they're trying to front load the agenda, because we're not seeing that level of specificity in the media. The principals involved in those meetings can tell us that, but it's going to break down. They're going to demand concessions before they come back to talks. And when it doesn't happen, then boom, we hit step eight, which is go back to step one and create the appearance of tension. We seem to be clearly in that cycle. When you go back and look at everything that's happened with the North Koreans over the years, they stay in that cycle and nothing ever gets solved.
Now, you're long retired from the military, but as far as you know, are people still looking at North Korean behavior and negotiating with North Korea through this prism of the cycle of eight steps?
Well, I know that it hasn't really gone away. I'm assuming that the United Nations command guys still are familiar with this concept, but I'm not sure that it's overriding on everything.
If you had the ear of Donald Trump or any of these senior people, what would you advise them?
You know, to be honest, they don't want to listen. And we see this time after time. The North Koreans never change. The same guys are there until they finally die. And the guys that have been their subordinates for the previous 15 or 20 years take over. On our side, we change all the time, and nobody wants to hear what we did before. We don't want to hear about past failures. We're going to show you how to make victory. I had some State Department guys roll in to set up the ADVON for Madeleine Albright's...
What's her ADVON?
Advance Party for Madeleine Albright's trip into North Korea in October of 2000. And so my boss, the two-star general at the time, different one than the
guy... The bachelor?
Yeah.
Okay.
That general had told me, hey, Steve, I want you to meet those guys and ride up to the JSA with them and explain to them about the way the North Koreans negotiate. And so we're in the van and said, hey, gentlemen, General Dunn thought I could give you some background on what we bump into up there and blah, 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 blah. And the senior guy, who's become very much more famous, turned to me and said, Colonel, thanks. We're the pros from Dover. We don't really need your help. He didn't say pros from Dover, but, you know, that's my insertion. But, yeah, we don't need your help. And they were very inept in their negotiations with the North Koreans. They didn't even know that the North Koreans had broke off for the night. You know, they just thought the North Koreans had taken a recess and said, so what time do you want to meet in the morning? Oh, well, they're coming back. I said, no, they're not. They said they were leaving. No, they didn't say that. I said, yes, they did. You just didn't hear it. They left. They're not coming back till tomorrow. What time would you like to meet them? You know, I mean, it was this level of ineptitude that I found kind of shocking. Then the next day, I had to actually negotiate the crossing, and so me and my counterpart, my drinking buddy, we did it in about 20, 25 minutes, and it was kind of, we're going to do it this way, and he said no, and I said yes, and State Department guys were concerned I was going to blow the deal, and I said, hey, I can't blow the deal. They're going to take so much money off of you guys, and they really, they're not going to let us, let me blow the deal for getting Madeleine Albright in there with Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-il, you don't understand. What I'm doing is nothing.
And it turns out that you were right in that way, yeah. So do you believe anything has changed or can change under Kim Jong-un?
I can't believe it can change under the current North Korean system. Kim Jong-un is required to be there because he's the descendant of the great leader and the dear leader. And the system is built around having that great leader and dear leader. There are 300,000 closest friends who are also part of the status quo up there. They've got an investment in all this. They have spent too much money on the nuclear weapons to get rid of them. And they also have a society where they have this royal family, the Kim family, that's really more like a Korean kingdom. And it's also a cross between a crime family and a religious cult. Because the guys at the top are worshipped to the point where you can't even think anything bad about them. You certainly can't say anything bad about them. And they can't change that. It's too hard to do. It will take some kind of internal insurrection or an external conflict to bring about a change in North Korea, I believe.
Now, you said earlier that you don't believe that people back in Washington want to hear from people with experience and knowledge about how to negotiate with North Korea. Okay, let's just say, you know, somebody did want to hear. What would you tell them?
Again, I don't believe, I know we have to go through this cycle, but I don't believe that we can be successful in getting what I think it is we want, which is the removal of all nuclear weapons and the capability to make nuclear weapons and long-range missiles in North Korea. The policy has been kick the can down the road, and hopefully they'll just go away on their own.
Well, what if we stop going around the cycle?
Well, it's not our cycle, it's their cycle.
Yes, but it only works if both sides keep reacting in the same way, right?
If you try not to react to them, then they just raise the tension until you have to react to them.
So there's continued escalation.
Right. And sometimes the media is responsible for this, too.
There are some who say that, okay, yeah, while North Korea does like to escalate things until it gets a response that it wants, there have been times over the years when if the response is to meet force with force, then North Korea tends to de-escalate. For example, take the Axe murder incident of 1976. Two Americans were killed with axes. The entire USFK was ready to go, you know, full-scale operations there, and they went in and cut the tree down, and North Korea didn't react. Similarly, with Yeonpyeongdo, Waipido, the second battle, in when South Korea shot back, and then that was the end, right? So there have been times when North Korea was met with force, and then North Korea, rather than taking the next step of escalating and continuing, withdraws and stops.
And the North Koreans do not want a war, because that's contrary to what North Korea is about. At the end of the day, this regime up there has got to continue to survive. That regime survival is the most important thing in North Korea. And they know a all-out war will mean the end of the regime leadership. Hence, the regime is dead, because they know we will target their leaders for, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, wartime assassination, because we're going to go after those command and control centers, and we're going to go for those senior leaders, because if we can kill them, then the war will go much quicker, we believe. I say that as something I believe, nothing I've ever seen when I was privy to seeing war plans and things like that. I just believe that we're going to see this. And in fact, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, even reinforced that either yesterday or today in an interview, saying, hey, I've seen how we're going to get these guys in wartime. So they're the ones that probably shouldn't sleep well at night. Anyway, based on that thing for regime survival, the North Koreans don't want to go too far. They got to be slick enough to be able to push the envelope up to right before it catches fire, then kind of back down. And that goes back to step one. You talk about the second Yeongpyeong battle. The North Koreans, they ambushed the South Korean boat on the final day of the World Cup here in the South.
Yeah.
When everybody's down in front of City Hall, which is around the corner here, in their red. And nobody really thought about those six sailors that had been killed that day. They're more worried about the game, I think it was against Brazil down in Ulsan. But the North Koreans had to kind of get their name in front of everybody, and so they did this on the last day. And then they got beat up pretty badly themselves, because their boats, their technology is very old. They're cranking guns around, and on our side, they're just pressing buttons, and guns are swinging back and forth, and have very good fire control radar that they're able to inflict a lot of casualties on the North Koreans.
Now, in our last 2 minutes together, would you like to give a plug for the books that you've written and published recently?
Well, I'm working on a series of DMZ tourism books. The first one on Paju is finished. I can't get Paju to sell the books for me at their tourist places, so I guess I'm just not connected with the right people up there. But I'm trying to finish a book on Yuncheon County right now, and then after that to Chorwon County. The fourth book will be on the eastern Gangwon province.
So you're moving across from west to east along the demilitarized zone.
And then the final book will be out of the demilitarized zone and cover the three observatories in the Han River estuary, and then Yeonpyeongdo and Baekyeongdo out in the West Sea.
Okay, it's a tour guide?
Right, these are tour guides. They're designed to help you know where to go, what days you can go, how much it's going to cost you, and how you can get there.
And where can people find these books? Is there a website that people can go to, or a bookstore?
Kyobo, I know, has them. Beyond Kyobo, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I'm not really in the marketing part of it.
Okay. What's the title of the book?
The overall title for all of them is Tharp's Guides to the Korean Front Lines. For the one that's published, it's called The Western DMZ Paju.
Okay. And that's Tharp, Tharp.
Right. Not two A's like the USFK Public Affairs Office thinks, but just one A, Tharp.
Okay. Well, thank you once again to retired Lieutenant Colonel Steve Tharp for coming on the NK News podcast. Don't forget, listeners, you can listen to all our shows as well as read full bios and show notes on our website, www.nknews.org. NK News is the leading repository of North Korean research, news, and analysis, and we hope to see you there. And you can send feedback, comments, questions, or guest suggestions to podcast@nknews.org. Our podcast was produced by Arias Dare and facilitated by Chad O'Carroll and Christina Lee. Lastly, a reminder that one random reviewer per week will win a free NK News membership, so please review us after listening and you might win. And you can save $50 off your NK News subscription by using the code PODCAST at the checkout. And whether you like this podcast or not, please share it with your friends, enemies, and relatives so that more people can listen. Thanks, and listen again next time.